It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, with a possible raise to the federal minimum wage and cuts to the food stamps program, we're checking in on just what it takes these days to make it in America. Let's start where these discussions so often do, on the campaign trail.
Poverty is not a trait of character. Today, millions of American families are caught in circumstances beyond their control. Their children will be compelled to live lives of poverty unless the cycle is broken.
Well, now, if government planning and welfare had the answer, and they've had almost 30 years of it, shouldn't they be telling us about the decline each year in the number of people needing help? Do they believe that poverty is suddenly going to disappear by magic?
Now, I am the son of an Irish father and a Sicilian mother. They both lived hard lives. Dad grew up in poverty. And after returning from Army service, he worked at the Breyers Ice Cream Plant in the 1950s. He put himself through Rutgers University at night to become the first in his family to earn a college degree.
In Washington, they call this the ownership society. But what it really means is that you're on your own. Out of work, tough luck, you're on your own. Born into poverty, pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. Even if you don't have boots, you are on your own.
In Texas, we believe in the rugged individual. Texas may be the one place where people actually still have bootstraps.
You know, for all the rhetoric, the struggle to make a decent living in the U.S. isn't just politics. It's personal. Here's a story from Arturo Camelot. He's a student at Tucson's City High School.
For most of my life, I've lived in poverty. But being the youngest in my family, I always felt secure. I remember my mom looking for the cheapest knockoff brands at the stores, as though the kids were throwing fits when they couldn't have what they wanted. I just stayed close to the carreta, and my mom would let me stand on the end of it. I never thought to ask why I always had to get hand-me-down clothes when all my friends had new stuff, or why half of my family slept on couches instead of beds. Fortunately, we had really big couches, but I never cared. I was a happy kid. I decided to interview my mom about this time in our lives, and her answer to my first question really surprised me.
Do you think we've ever lived in poverty?
I don't think we've lived in poverty. We've lived poor, but I'm never in poverty. I mean, we've always had a roof over our head, food on the table, and sometimes no money to pay everything, but I made a way either way.
Still, looking back, I think we've lived in poverty. We lived off of welfare in Section 8, which is a federal program that provides rent money for low-income families. But my mom likes to keep a positive mind, so you won't hear her admit that things were ever that bad.
So when we were living off of Section 8 and welfare, what bothered you the most about it? Did anything bother you, or were you just happy?
I think I was happy because, maybe because there was no struggle. You know, there was no really responsibility. You know, I had money handed to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the truth. Although I don't agree with people abusing it, but it was needed and it was a stepping stone for me to get up and do something.
My mom said she was happy back then, but I remember sadness following her every step. She was constantly under some kind of stress. She never took it out on us, but sometimes at night we would hear her crying in her room while she was praying or doing the bills. To me, those days kind of represent rock bottom for our family. But my mom didn't see it that way.
You don't consider living off of welfare in Section 8 rock bottom?
I didn't think so.
I kind of see that as low, because you're like, you can't make it on your own. You need the government in mm-hmm. order to survive. I remember the dude, the chubby guy with the clipboard coming every month.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys...
Inspecting the house.
That's and how irritated he'd made you, no matter how funny he was.
Why do you think I was irritated?
Because you'd be like, I hate when that guy comes over. I hate having to tell him all of our stuff.
Yeah, that's true.
He needs to mind his own business. Let's tell us.
Oh, well, yeah. It's like invading your personal space. But that's just how it is, you know. And it's just like, you know, you apply for food stamps and stuff. And They want to know who's in your house, how much you make. They want to see your pay stubs. They have to know everything.
Yeah.
I wanted to know how it ever got to that point where we were living off of welfare in Section 8. So I asked my mom.
Do you remember any choices you made that
got me in the rut?
Yeah.
Yeah, I went and didn't finish school or didn't finish college. And then I had babies out of wedlock where there was no security, no income from your dad. It was just me.
It's upsetting that my mom went through all this struggle, and it's weird knowing that I'm part of it. I was one of those babies that she had to struggle to feed. But then again, if it weren't for her struggle, I probably wouldn't be here. Still, I wish my mom could have certain things, like a good education.
I should have finished my schooling, got a degree in something. I'd be probably making more than I am now.
Do you think it's too late?
Oh, no.
To go to school and get...
No, it's not too late. I'm just too tired. It's like raising kids again. I don't want to raise kids again, and I don't want to go to school again.
Oh, I see.
I understand why my mom is so tired, but thankfully things have gotten better. We are not on welfare Section 8, and now my mom works at the wastewater treatment facility for Pima County as an office support, or even paying off the mortgage on a home. Still, there's things we want we cannot afford to have.
We do. We have enough. Sometimes there's things in the refrigerator we don't want to eat, or maybe we don't have meat, but we have everything else like potatoes and stuff. But, it just makes me want to do more and not have like more stuff, but have, if I want a gallon of milk, if I want to go get me an ice cream, if I want a steak, I want to have the money to go get it.
Mm-hmm.
A ribeye steak. Not Chuck. And even though that's expensive now, too.
Right now, I'm looking for a job and starting to think about life after high school. I want to go to college, but I can't really afford it. Looking at how I've done in school so far, I can't imagine too many scholarships coming my way. I know I want to go into corrections as a career, so I'm contemplating joining the military and hoping they'll put me through school. I'd like to own my own home someday. And I'd like to buy my mother a nicer home that's closer to her work. I don't necessarily want to be rich, but if my mom wants a ribeye steak, I want her to have her ribeye steak.
That's Arturo Camelot and his mother Araceli. Their radio piece was part of the City High radio program from Tucson, Arizona. Arturo's dream is pretty simple. A house for him and his mom, maybe a job in corrections. There's probably an original American dream for everyone in this country. But Georgetown law professor Peter Edelman says that government policies can either help or hinder people on the road to economic stability. Edelman's the longtime policy advisor who quit Bill Clinton's administration when the president signed new welfare laws. Laws that, in Edelman's opinion, destroyed the social safety net. Steve Paulson asked him whether it's still possible for someone with a lot of hard work and determination to make it in America.
Statistically, it's not true. Certainly, there are wonderful stories all the time of children who were born into the most abject poverty and have immense talent and who beat the odds. But statistics go the other way.
So do you think this Horatio Alger story, the sort of you can become something from nothing, is that a dangerous myth?
It is in terms of believing that the odds are the same for everybody, because they're simply not. If you're born into a family that isn't making enough money to get by and you live in a neighborhood that's unsafe, where you're likely to go to lousy schools, where you have the added problems of being a racial minority, it's just not the same for everybody.
How big a problem is poverty in the United States right now?
much bigger than it should be. We have 46 million people who are poor by the way we count poverty, which I think is probably an undercount. The poverty line is about $19,000 for a family of three. And in fact, we have something like 20 million people whose incomes are below half the poverty line in extreme poverty. So it's a big problem.
20 million people earning half the official poverty line level, you have to wonder how they survive.
You do have to wonder how they survive. And in fact, it's worse than that because there's 6 million people whose only income is from food stamps. Having food stamps means you have an income of about $6,000, a little more than that, for a family of three, a third of the poverty line. So then you really wonder how people make it. It's really just astonishing that a country with all of this wealth would have that big a problem.
So you're saying food stamps are essential. I mean, they're one of the last safety nets out there.
Food stamps are vital. In the recession, which is technically over, but not for millions of people, is it over? We went from having 26 million people on food stamps at the beginning back in 2007-08 to 48 million right now. Many of them have jobs and just don't make enough money from the job, and the food stamps are an absolutely essential income supplement. And then we have those people that I talked about who have nothing else.
So why is poverty such an endemic problem? Why can't we raise the standards of living for everyone out there?
Well, first of all, we've done a lot. Back in the 1960s, when we had kind of everything going for us, we in fact cut poverty in half, got it down to 11%. And what we've done in terms of food stamps and earned income tax credit and, of course, Social Security for the elderly, we've done a lot. The problem is that our economy has changed. We've become a low-wage country. Because of globalization and technology, the jobs that we have, so many of them now pay not enough to live on. That's the heart of it.
Of course, there's a vigorous debate right now to raise the federal minimum wage. Do you think that's important?
It's extremely important. And the idea, again, that we're going to destroy all these jobs, that no employer can afford to raise the minimum wage, these are all certainly concerns in a somewhat complicated situation. But to raise to $10.10, if you look at the research and
right now it's what, $7.25 an hour?
Correct. Mm-hmm. And the president has proposed raising it to $10.10. That would take a few million people out of poverty, probably have an effect in pushing wages up above that to some extent. It is on net a step in the right direction. We'd still have too many low-wage jobs. But we haven't had an increase for now the better part of a decade, and we're way behind where we were in the late 60s in the purchasing value of the minimum wage.
Well, what about those businesses who say that they could not afford to raise wages for basically entry-level jobs, or in some industries, running the risk of outsourcing those jobs to other countries with truly low wages?
There's some truth. And if you talk about having a minimum wage of, let's say, $20 an hour, it's something that we really can't do, at least not all at once, because the research shows that that would have an effect in terms of destroying more jobs than we would want to. But at $10.10, generally, it's not the case. And so on all of these, there are complexities, but the basic point is that as a nation and with relatively little hurt to individual employers, we should be moving forward on this right now.
Okay, so part of your program to fight poverty is to raise the minimum wage. What else?
The question of income is certainly very basic. And so we have the earned income tax credit for families with children. We need to extend that so that the millions of people who don't have children who are out there in low-wage jobs and in poverty can do better. We need to invest in our children in terms of the 0 to 5s, who all the research shows are affected negatively if they're not ready to start kindergarten at 5. And, of course, education all the way through, everything about the future of children. Health care is vital.
Wait, just to stop for a moment. When you say invest in children, you're basically saying start kindergarten earlier.
I'm starting with 0. Moms are out there working and they don't have child care. And in many cases, because they don't have child care, they can't work. So I'm starting at zero. We should definitely have pre-K all over the country. We've had this huge increase in the number of single moms in the labor force. They don't have a second person to stay at home, and the only income they get is from these low-wage jobs. And so well over 40% of single moms with children are poor. It's the largest single group of people who are poor in the country.
And what about health care? And more specifically, what about Obamacare? How does that figure into this whole discussion of poverty?
Well, very much so. We don't count health care in income as a technical matter, but it makes a huge difference. If people are healthy, they can work. If children are healthy, they're going to grow up with their full capacities and possibilities.
Now, it seems to me that we as a society have a really hard time talking about poverty. I mean, we know politicians talk a lot about the middle class, about trying to, you know, make their lives better, but we don't actually talk very much about the poor, especially the very poor. I guess I'm wondering what it would take to have a national discussion about poverty.
That's a question I ask myself. We need that discussion. The polling shows that there's much less support when you talk about a direct attack on poverty. And I think we could change that with a national discussion and national leadership that says this is just unconscionable in a country of this wealth to have this many people who are left behind. Now, if you look at the polling data, if you talk about investing in education, health care, housing, ending hunger, people are supportive of doing that, on up about 70%, supporting those kinds of things that have a name other than using the word poverty. The debate in our country tends to be between, are these structural problems or is it all the fault of the individual? You know, is it all the fault of the person who didn't try, who didn't take responsibility for himself, herself, or her children? It's both. The fact is we all have to take responsibility for ourselves. Still, if our children go to lousy schools, if health care is not available, if housing is terrible, if there are no jobs or all the jobs don't pay enough to live on, those are very real problems that are keeping people in poverty, and it's not the fault. And that's millions and millions of people. You know, the idea that there are 48 million people who are on food stamps right now and they're all some kind of lazy people, that's ridiculous.
You know, as I listen to you, it's enough to despair over this. Do you despair or do you still have optimism?
Oh, I do have optimism because we have done so much that's right. We do have a list of public policies that really weren't there. Some of them start from the 30s, some start from the 60s. Housing vouchers, earned income tax credit, all of these things that do make a difference. The problem is that we're pushing against these economic pressures, this massive number of low-wage jobs. I mean, after all, with this president, with all the difficulties he's had, they accomplished, with Congress, of course, the Affordable Care Act, and that's within our immediate memory. And sure, it's tremendously controversial, and there are people who hate it, but it's a huge accomplishment. So no, I'm not pessimistic. I think it means that we need to keep working on these things. We need political leaders, we need civic leaders, we need people who speak up about these things.
That's Georgetown Law Professor Peter Adelman. His latest book is called So Rich, So Poor: Why It's So Hard to End Poverty in America. And one of this country's enduring ideas, even an everyday saying, is that it's possible to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. Now, of course, it's physically impossible to grab onto four little straps and just yank yourself into the air. But producer Sarah Nix thought there had to be a way to do it, maybe with levers or pulleys and some well-built boots. She stopped by a University of Wisconsin engineering lab where Glenn Bauer gave her a leg up.
First off, we've got a hook that's connected to a steel structure. From there, we have the chain hoist hitched up.
And that's essentially a pulley system, is it?
Yeah, it's a pulley system, and then there's one set of chain. What we'll do is we'll hitch that to the bootstraps.
All right, let me get my boots.
All right.
I'm actually wearing my fantastic winter boots, where I got the idea because they have bootstraps built into them. However, I can't afford to replace them if they break. Got some not-so-great secondhand cowboy boots. They do appear to be leather, and there are loops on both sides. So I'm hoping that the boots themselves are not going to break. but I guess we will see.
These are basically, most people use these as emergency links. We'll have one of these on each side, and then we're going to have to cut the chain and then attach it to here. Okay.
This is somehow like the opposite of a Cinderella story. I honestly do not know if these boots are up to the task.
So now, this is the one you're going to have to hang on to for balance, and then you want to pull that one down.
You can't tell. It happens so slowly. Oh. Well, I am actually in the air now.
Yes, you are. You're off the floor about, I'd say, an inch now.
I am. In fact, I have lifted myself up by my bootstraps with the help of what?
We call this a chain hoist.
So it turns out that with 16-some different apparatuses, one can lift oneself up.
Yes, a short distance. If you had to go 6 feet, I would go get lunch.
Now, how do I get down?
Yep.
That's Sarah Nix with Glenn Bauer. He's the senior scientist for the University of Wisconsin's Engine Research Center. And this is To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Anybody can be somebody in America, right? That's part of our national identity. From those Horatio Alger self-made man stories to religious freedom and prosperity, there are countless versions of the American dream, as historians Richard Weiss and Jim Cullen told us.
The self-help tradition, the rags-to-riches tradition, really begins in the 19th century, but it has its antecedents in those early religious settlements in the New World.
When you look back at the Puritan American dream, I mean, here are people who wanted to start their lives over, by some lights succeeded quite nicely, and yet within a generation, you hear this mantra that runs through their sermons, we are not the men our fathers were. We have failed to sustain our intensity. We haven't gotten things right.
Probably the most popular sources of this idea before Horatio Alger were the McGuffey readers in the 1830s and 40s. Books for children to learn to read and write by and stuff, but they included these stories of the relationship between character and worldly success.
Lincoln was the epitome of one of the great American dreams, that is upward mobility. For him, ending slavery, saving the Union were both means to a larger end, preserving a country in which an ordinary guy like himself could start out in a log cabin, marry a rich girl, and become a wealthy lawyer, and who knows, maybe even president of the United States.
Horatio Alger is really the most well-known of the 19th century rags-to-riches writers. For the most part, the heroes are male. The circumstance that gets them into difficulty is that their fathers usually die.
The dilemma that the American dream poses is it's something that is widely shared. And ironically, the very fact that it is widely shared ends up sowing divisions.
You know, the self-help tradition, the rags-to-riches tradition, believes that right is rewarded and evil is punished. If you're not successful, it's related to some kind of characterological deficiency. That's one of the things that makes failure very painful for Americans.
What I think of as the very center of the American dream is this notion of agency, that your desire, your will, your talent can have transformative power. Not that everyone will succeed, but rather that there is this notion of opportunity, that anyone can make it in America. How you feel about that standard will, to a great degree, determine how you feel about the American dream as a whole.
Jim Cullen and Richard Weiss, they're both historians who've written about the American dream. You can find our full-length interviews with them and links to their books on our website at ttbook.org. Now, we all know, if you want to make it in America, a good education gets you a long way. And that's especially true if you're not a white kid from a high-income family. So when Idris Brewster got accepted into Dalton, an elite prep school in Manhattan, his parents decided to go ahead and enroll him, even though he'd be one of the only African-American students there. And they made a documentary about it. All of it, in fact, American Promise, traces the family's 13-year journey through Dalton. When I talked with Joe Brewster and Michelle Stevenson, I started by asking them about the uncertainties that most parents have about their children's futures, especially in uncertain economic times.
For me, in terms of what this level of anxiety kind of meant is, coming from a black immigrant family from the Caribbean, first generation college educated, so for me, education was the ticket. So it was this level of anxiety and need and drive to inculcate that same kind of perspective to the next generation, because we know how fragile for us middle class status is, especially within the black community and other communities of color as we look at the statistics today. Mm. So one of the things that I knew that could not be taken away from Idris is his education and skill level. And the better that education, the more doors would be open.
You remind me of a clip from the film, which I think we have. It's from very early on in the documentary, just as you were making the decision to enroll Idris at Dalton, this very elite prep school in Manhattan. Let's hear this clip.
Idris is extremely bright. He's very curious and sensitive. Maybe those are terms that all parents use for their children. But he scored in the top 2 or 3% in terms of these educational testing. So we have a lot of expectations.
It's gonna hopefully allow him to compete at the top level with his peers.
What do you say, Bobby? I thought you said Britney Spears.
No, that's not what I said.
But who is Britney Spears?
Britney Spears is a singer.
How old was Idris then?
5.
Oh, he's just so adorable in the film. And Michelle, you didn't actually, at the very first, you weren't necessarily that keen on him going to Dalton. You thought it was a school for rich white kids. What changed your mind?
Well, what changed my mind were a couple of things. One is visiting that school, seeing really how individualized the attention appeared to be. The level of academic exposure was just amazing to see. And then hearing them talk about their mission to really create a more multicultural environment within the student body, and that it was a mission that they were taking seriously.
But what we're really talking about is our son turning into a great human being. We're looking at critical thinking. We're looking at academic achievement. And what we thought was that the diversity would help ensure that. We were led to believe that that school would look like the city of New York, not just in terms of race, mm-hmm. but in terms of social class and geographical diversity. Mm-hmm. But it didn't happen. There were 3 boys of color in the kindergarten class of 90.
So let's talk about how the experience actually played out. Early on at Dalton, you got a note from the school. Actually, we've got that clip. Let's take a listen.
They told us that our son is a hard-to-manage guy. He's not a hard-to-manage guy. He's soft-spoken. He's eager. My concern is that they don't know him.
Right.
There's great difficulty with impulse control, both physically and verbally.
He talks out of turn continually, has trouble respecting other
students' physical boundaries. A goal for him is to make an extra effort to focus on activities without distracting others. Okay.
They've decided that our son is a problem. He's not a problem at home. He's not a problem in the community. He's a problem at Dalton. And the question is, what is it about Idris that makes him disruptive?
Well, not so much what it's about him. What is it about the environment?
I don't know.
So that was in grade one, two? I mean, do you think there was some kind of cultural disconnect or misperception happening way back then?
Absolutely. I mean, he came home in kindergarten. What did he say to me? He says, you know, Dad, they keep asking me, am I rich or am I poor? I keep saying, I'm in the middle, but they keep asking me. He was dealing with perception the day he walked in the door, whether he was a poor kid from the inner city.
I think part of what, as I re-listen to these comments, the phrasing of it is not self-reflecting on what is it that I as a teacher can do to make him feel more comfortable, to make him feel more entitled and feel a part of the community.
So you think the teachers were not sort of intervening when Idris was continually being asked to identify himself?
I think they were equally projecting their own assumptions onto their interactions with him, and probably without even realizing that they were doing it.
At what age were you able to have that conversation with Idris and explain to him what was going on in a way that he could really understand and also use?
We always talk about it, but it's not explicit, the conversation. We begin by giving him an appreciation for who he is.
One example is even in terms of his name, Idris. He came to us very early on about wanting to change his name because he heard other names in the classroom and that this made him feel different. So we sat down and talked to him on multiple times about the proud history behind his name. Idris was the first mortal to read. In the Quran, that there's a whole North African tradition of using his name and why we picked it to make him proud.
Now, one of the things that crops up in the film is that despite the presumably great teaching at Dalton, Idris and his friend Shan, who are also at the school, were maybe falling behind the other students. Let's hear this clip.
We got a letter from Dalton inviting Idris to participate in this tutoring program. And he was having some issues in fourth grade, but we didn't know they were going to recommend tutoring. So I asked, how was he selected? And she told me, well, we offer this to students who are on financial aid, so it's a way to make it more of a level playing field. But then we found out that in Idris's grade, he and Shayon are the only two kids in the entire grade taking this tutoring program. I don't want the tutoring to be at the expense of him being perceived a certain way that's totally inaccurate. I think that there's a perception that these are young black boys who need extra help because they're not used to this kind of exposure.
What the school says is that many of his classmates are receiving tutoring.
Some of the parents are spending up to $30,000 a year for tutoring. That's more than the tuition.
So throughout the film, it's clear that Idris and Shayon are really smart kids, and they work really hard at school. But it just seems like these questions of race and income keep getting muddled up with their education.
That particular clip is really central in kind of understanding the multiple levels that we're talking about around how the field is not level and how rules change. And they have to do with race and class. Class in the sense that we were not aware that there were so many other white students taking tutoring at home. And the school was attempting to do the right thing, but didn't realize the racial consequences of that.
Here are two young men perceived as struggling. Even during their most intense struggles, they were still testing at the highest level and began to lose confidence in themselves, lose confidence in their ability to learn, and lose confidence in their ability to have a future.
At some point, did you begin to worry that about whether this whole experience was going to wind up sapping Idris's self-confidence?
Absolutely. And we began to intervene in a major way. We began to try to bolster his esteem at home. We began to work on his organization. We began to expose him to people who looked like him, who were proud of their academic heritage and their love for reading, writing, art.
You guys also, you worked with Idris to come up with a pretty serious study schedule. I mean, there are all these scenes. It looks pretty intense. I mean, there are these scenes of Idris studying late into the night, looking totally exhausted, and you guys are really on him about, you know, did you finish this homework? What do you mean you don't have your book? Were all the other Dalton families that intense about the academics, or do you feel like you pushed Idris harder?
Well, one of the struggles that we have as African-American parents is being demanding enough. So what you saw is my attempt to limit some of the time that was not being spent adequately.
The bottom line for us, and I think for many African-American families and Latino families, the bar is too low when it comes to looking at the potential and what they're capable of academically. And we have to kind of fight that projection. And
We're proponents of unstructured time and free play. But if we look at the numbers in terms of who's achieving, who's not achieving, there's almost a linear relationship between, you know, study hours. And so what you see in the film is we see us as families saying, this is our commitment to education, and it's a daily commitment, and we're going to enforce that. And we understand everyone doesn't have the same level of involvement, but it worked for Idris.
You sent Idris to Dalton to raise the bar for him, as you said, and do you feel like that level playing field exists for Idris now?
No. The level playing field, it does not exist because our society hasn't changed to that extent. But what he does have is a critical awareness of the structure that exists around him and how he can navigate the different environments.
For the rest of his life, unless American society changes pretty dramatically, the implicit bias continues to exist, and we're giving our son the tools to deal with that, and he's going to be able to compensate.
Compensate or challenge in a way that's constructive for everyone involved, because what we do know is that there is a societal and economic cost to the current status quo around race and race relations and assumptions, and we're all paying a cost for that.
Do you think there can be a level playing field?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I look at it, how do you say it? The level playing field is the ideal, right? It's that utopia that we look for.
I think it's not going to happen in my lifetime. It's like that old rickety table in the restaurant. We know ways of putting a matchbook underneath one leg and making it work for that meal. And I think that's what we're doing.
Michelle Stevenson and Joe Brewster's documentary is called American Promise. You can see a trailer on our website, ttbook.org, where you can also listen to our extended conversation. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for Watch This, Sarah Nix and Charles Monroe Kane catch us up on documentaries just released for streaming.
They just gave out the Academy Awards for this year. Charles, you watched one of the nominees for Best Documentary Short, right?
I did. I watched Karima Has No Walls. Karima means dignity, by the way, in Arabic. It's a short 30-minute film that's an eyewitness account of the day in 2011 during the Arab Spring in Yemen when pro-government snipers opened fire on a peaceful gathering of protesters. It killed 53 people almost instantly. The killing sparked national outrage and actually overthrew the government. But you know, Sarah, it's worth watching the film, even though you're going to see a lot of people get killed, and people have to know that's going to happen. But it's worth watching it because rarely do you get this chance to see not only a revolution take place, but see it from the point of view from the people. We all saw news reports from the Arab Spring, but we didn't see it from their eyes. Not in this way. I've never seen anything like it.
Well, I had an easier time of it. I watched the documentary short that won the Oscar this year. It's called The Lady in Number 6, Music Saved My Life. It's the story of Alice Hertz-Sommer, who was a concert pianist before she was sent to a concentration camp during the Nazi regime. Her music kept her alive, but more than a story of survival, it's more a story of optimism and hope and also the power of music. Here's a clip.
I knew that we will play. And I was thinking, when we can play, it can't be so terrible. The music.
You know, these films, they're both short, less than 30 minutes, but they're powerful. And if you're not ready to commit to a 90-minute film, I would definitely recommend documentary shorts for you.
I agree. And one more thing I want to add is that Alice Hertz-Sommers died about a week before the film won the Academy Award. She was 110 years old, and I think we should probably go out on some of her playing.
Absolutely.
That was Sarah Nix and Charles Monroe Kane with Watch This. You can see trailers of the documentaries they talked about on our website at ttbook.org. Now, if you're in the mood for more movies and you have a taste for Scandinavian noir, you might want to see if the Swedish thriller Easy Money, Hard to Kill is playing at your local theater. The movie's based on the hard-boiled crime novels of Jens Lapidus. By day, he's a criminal defense lawyer in Stockholm. And as Steve Paulson discovered, Lapidus is not a big fan of most Swedish crime novels, including those by superstar writers Henning Mankell and Stieg Larsson.
I see myself as a hybrid between American and Scandinavian traditions, and I get a lot of my inspiration from American crime writers rather than Scandinavian ones.
Which American writers?
Well, I'm greatly influenced by James Ellroy, for example, Dennis Lehane, and older ones like Raymond Chandler and Elmer Leonard. Hard-boiled, much focus on dialogue and scenery and character, maybe not so much focus on plot. Whilst Scandinavian is more, I think, has more in common with the traditional British jigsaw mystery whodunit fiction. Mm-hmm. I write about true crime, a lot of what's really going on in Sweden nowadays, and it's violent.
So this is not that. I mean, I've read the Stieg Larsson novels. Read a lot of Henning Mankell. Yeah. This is quite different.
Yeah,
world.
Well, my goal is to turn Henning Mankell style 180 degrees upside down and really expand the limits for Scandinavian crime fiction. And that also goes for the language, where I sort of try to create a language that, in its very style, is hard cut and stylistically violent. Much more like James Ellroy or dialogue of Dennis Lehane, for example, than you will find in Mankell.
So are you saying that Mankell is not really depicting the Sweden that you know?
Oh, not at all. It's more of a genre, a style, where it starts off with a murder and then you have a police investigator investigating the murder, and at the end of the book you will have the solution to who did it. But I mean, firstly, murders are not that common, and especially not this bestial, you know, someone hanging upside down in a tree with a cross carved into this body. That just doesn't happen in Sweden. But what we do have is a lot of drug problem, gang violence, domestic violence, prostitutions, and so on. So I try to depict that word, which is, for me, a bit of a curse and a blessing, because now there's a wave of Scandinavian crime fiction going all over the world.
And people are familiar with people are familiar with Henning Mankell, and then with Stieg Larsson, so the girl with the dragon tattoo. It presents an image of Sweden too. And these are writers who were politically on the left. They cared a lot about the social welfare system there. There was kind of a philosophy behind their
fiction. They want to convey this message of social criticism, which I think is quite typical for Scandinavian crime.
So you're saying your books, I mean, your depiction of the crime world is more realistic, more accurate than the tradition of most Scandinavian crime fiction.
No, absolutely. I mean, I'm a public defense lawyer, so...
So you work with these kinds of criminals?
I work with these kinds of criminals, or allegedly criminals. And I do see this word pretty at close hand. So, yes. Having said that, it's fiction. My characters are not real people, but a lot of the detail you will find in my books is from the streets of Stockholm.
Do you actually take notes from your work and sort of, okay, this is something that would work in a later novel?
Yeah, I take a lot of notes. If I come across something, maybe they use a way to use their mobile phones in order not to be wiretapped. So I do write that down, and I might use it later on as a piece of fact in my books. So yes, I do. My books are very extremely popular among... My books are the most borrowed books in the Swedish prison library system. So
the inmates, they're like reading your books.
Yeah, I think they do. I mean, first of all, they see that it's pretty close to reality. They see that the style is pretty close to how they actually do speak. And also, I think they see that I don't try to depict criminals as monsters. Because for me, it's not a question of black and white, monster or angel. It's a question of shades of gray. If I can move the reader just for 2 seconds into the head of the criminal and get the reader for a few seconds to identify with the criminal, then I have succeeded.
So how has this affected your law practice? I mean, do some of these people seek you out, want you to represent them because they've read your books?
Yeah, I mean, it's not bad to be known as an author in Sweden, but at the end of the day, you have to do your thing in the courtroom, and it doesn't matter if you wrote 100 books, it doesn't make you a better lawyer. I mean, I choose to stick to my job as a defense lawyer, although I would be much better off financially if I just did writing. But for me personally, I like to have a proper job with an office and colleagues, and I think it's great, really exciting to be part of the legal world.
Do you like working with these people, representing the people you do? I mean, some of these elements from the criminal underworld?
I don't like them, and I sometimes hate what they have done, but I like defending a system, and I like being part of a legal system where anyone, no matter how heinous the crime, has the right of a defense. I'm also a bit of a, what do you call it in English, I like to win, you know, so I like the fight. I like sort of the excitement in the courtroom. I mean, I use also, in my books, you will find that the cops are not there.
Well, and that's also another big difference between your books and, say, Henning Mankell's. I mean, his are basically police procedurals. Mm. I mean, they're following on the trail of the detective who's trying to unravel the story. Cops don't really figure much in your books at all. I mean, it's basically about the criminals.
Yeah, I had this case a couple of years ago. It was about... 3 young men that went into an apartment and they beat up and robbed the people at the apartment. And we were having the trial for a couple of days. It's a very severe crime. They were facing long sentences. And at the end of the trial, the judge, she was turning to them and she asked, "Where do you see yourself within 5 years? Who are you within 5 years? What are you doing?" She was in effect extending her hand, really trying to get them to say maybe that they want to change their lives, get a job, study, become citizen. But she got quite the opposite reaction. They were standing up in the chairs, and I can tell you, standing up in a Swedish courtroom, that in itself is something very upsetting, because you sit down, everybody sits down. It's not like in America. Anyway, they were standing up, And they started shouting and they said, you don't understand anything. You don't understand the way we live. You don't understand that what we're doing is natural. This is the way, this life to us, it's normal. So I came home that night and I switched on my computer and I wrote my first fictional piece ever in my life. And it was a short story of a robbing and beating in an apartment. But I didn't write it from the perspective of a policeman coming in, investigating the crime scene and so forth, or from the perspective of a victim. I did write it seen via the eyes of one of the criminals. Because I figured if in Sweden, Stockholm today, we have people for whom it's normal, it's a way of life. You know, I go to my job 9 o'clock in the morning, they go to their job and beat up people to commit these crimes. It also must be interesting and fascinating to be in the head of these people. And it had never been done before in Swedish literature. So it really, you know, it came as a bomb in the Swedish literary world and Scandinavia.
No, my sense is that most crime writers, fiction writers, often want to moralize about the tales that they're telling. I mean, the bad guys are usually punished at the end. As you say, the crimes are usually wrapped up. I mean, there's a whodunit quality, partly, I suppose, to make the reader feel good. You want the bad elements to be purged by the end of the story. Do you share that philosophy?
No, quite the opposite. I'm a big fan of Dennis Lehane, for example. I don't know if you read Lehane's Gone Baby Gone, for example. At the end of that book, you will feel more confused morally. You will continue to think about that book because at the end, status quo is not there. Chaos is still there. There's still a problem in the world. And I think that's how the world is. So I think that what you're mentioning is also a problem of genre literature, that it tries always to fit into the structure. And that's why a lot of the crime writing we see will never reach the quality of real literature, so to speak. I mean, it's good stuff, but it's sometimes you can feel that the quality is lacking. So I try to go away from that way of writing. I'm not so interested in moralizing. I'm not interested in a political agenda. I'm interested in pointing out that society is not perfect, but I have no solution to it, really.
That's Jens Lapidus talking with Steve Paulson about his crime novel Easy Money. The Swedish movie adaptation Easy Money, Hard to Kill, has just been released in the U.S. And speaking of writing, remember our 3-minute flash fiction contest? More than 750 of you sent in stories. We had a lot of reading to do. And so many great stories and great ideas. Our partners at the University of Wisconsin Center for the Humanities and the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery are going through them now, and they will head next to contest judge Kim Stanley Robinson. We'll air the winners right here on April 13th, so stay tuned. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Sarah Nix, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Stephanie Youngblood, and Doug Gordon. And this week we welcome our new producer, Raymond Tangakar. We're so glad to have him with us. Steve Mullen from Walk West Music composed our theme music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.